So, Jonathan, Michael, welcome. We're really looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Good evening. Thank you very much indeed, Chris, for that introduction. Michael and I are going to talk to you about this topic, and we're doing it boxing and coxing. I'm going to start, then Michael comes on, so we'll be moving backwards and forwards. But it'll be a seamless exercise, I can assure you. It's interesting that in the paper this week on Monday, there was some extracts from a lecture given by the person who was apparently the favourite, I know this, to be the next Archbishop of Canterbury, John Welby, the Bishop of Durham. And he's a member of the House of Lords Banking Standards Commission, which is drawing up recommendations for a new banking act. And he said, one principle seems clear. We cannot repair what was destroyed in 2008. We can only replace it with something that is dedicated to the support of human society, to the common good, and to solidarity. Well, we'd all agree with that. And he went on to say, the contention I'm making is that too much effort is going into putting Humpty back together again, and it can't happen. One of the biggest faults in the pre-2008 financial markets was that they were exponents of anarchy, quote, he said. They involved wild and frantic activity, but they had no socially useful purpose. The industry was referred to as financial services, but in fact it served nothing. Well, you can leave now if you like. I mean, yeah, we've got to match up to that introduction. Now, there are quite a few issues that he's talking about there, particularly talking about banks and the bonuses and so on, what's happened with the breakup of the banks and whether you split them into retail and wholesale markets, into those type of businesses. But a lot of the principles he mentioned, a lot of the issues of concern apply to the companies generally. And I think it's fair to say that society has generally lost confidence and trust and faith in many aspects of the corporate world. And yet, we need companies as the engine to drive the economy, to provide jobs and wealth creation for the benefit of society. Now we're going to talk about that, and we're going to introduce you to an approach which, without any new laws or any new regulation, would transform the way companies operate, so that they operate as a community for the benefit of all stakeholders, all the stakeholders who have an interest in the company and society generally, and not just for the benefit of shareholders. And we also want to tell you how we can play a part in this transformation of the business world. We've given an equivalent talk to this, but each one different, at University College London, in the House of Commons, in New York, in Boston, and other places. So we've had quite a wide audience. And it's based on this research report we prepared, which was published last year, Transforming Capitalism from Within, Relational Approach to the Purpose, Performance, and Assessment of Companies. It is on sale for £10, but I believe this evening there's a special offer. It's going for £7. And there are copies somewhere, Michael. So everything we're talking about is in there, expanded on a considerable length. Now let's look at some of the current problems in the business world, in the corporate world. And a lot of these, all these, I think, are covered in press articles, not just in the business press, but in the general press. The short-termism, again, we know about this, the short-term view that investors are looking for instant and increasing and regular returns. There's this requirement for listed companies to report on a quarterly basis. So there are constant demands on companies to continue to produce ever-increasing returns for shareholders. Share dealing is on a short-term basis. People deal in nanoseconds sometimes, going in and out of shares depending on the share price. And there are contracts for differences, CDCs, shorting, where people borrow shares, sell them and buy them back. And it's nothing to do with the underlying company at all. There are synthetic dealings. The share dealing so often takes place with no interest in what's happening to the employees, what's happening to the business, when it's expanding in this country or overseas, whether people are being made redundant, but purely to get a financial return. So it's a bit of a lottery. Shares are treated as a commodity with no interest generally in the underlying business. And if a problem arises, what do people do? They just sell the shares. They get out and go into another company. The whole pay differential thing is always in the headlines. There's a widening gap between the highest and the lowest paid in companies. Give you an example. A couple of years ago, FTSE 100 directors increased remuneration package of about 55% for the 350 largest companies on the listed on the listing market, 45%, and yet the average salary of people in the country is going up about 1 or 2%. Now, thanks to the shareholder spring, so-called, this year, there's been some kickback from shareholders, and actually this year it's been much less, but it doesn't matter. There is a huge differential. Supposing the person in at the Tesco checkout earns, I don't know, 10,000. Would it be reasonable for a senior person in the company to earn, say, 10 times that, or 100 times that, or 1,000 times that, 1,000 times more, which is 10 million? Well, the senior people probably earn more than that. Now, what does it say to the dignity of the employee? What does it say to the employee about their worth to the company that they're being paid such a tiny fraction of what the senior people are being paid? They work hard. The checkout person, as you know, has a difficult time dealing with customers. They don't work long hours. They work at weekends. So does it actually value them to the business? And what does it say to them as individuals? There are contrary approaches. For instance, John Lewis with their bonus scheme, at least all the employees get the same percentage bonus. Obviously, the amount's different because the salaries are different. And we're going to come and address this, but no less a person than our Prime Minister, David Cameron, said before the election, he hasn't said it since, that in the civil service, there should be no greater pay differential than 20 to 1. And John Pierpont Morgan, that well-known banker, J.P. Morgan, a century or so ago, also said that there shouldn't be a pay differential of greater than 20 to 1 between the highest and lowest pay, because he said if you go beyond that, it damages morale and people don't feel included and encouraged. Debt levels, well, as we know from a personal perspective, all these are getting worse and worse. This is a big problem for the country with credit card debt and bank debt and mortgage debt and so on. Companies just pile on the debt. I know this from my practice. They take on a lot of debt to do mergers and acquisitions because they want to get instant return. They want to, the chief executive wants his reputation boost by doing a lot of deals. But of course, if you have a high debt level, that's fine when the company's earning enough profits to service the debt, to pay the interest. It's fine when the market's there to refinance because new debt is available. But what happens in a downturn? It may not be the fault of the company, it may be the economy, it may be the state of that sector of the market. Then, of course, the company gets into difficulties. And what happens? It has to start laying off people, laying off employees. And, of course, what shareholders don't realise, if there is a real difficulty with covenants from the debt, and what happens, the banks and the other debt holders will convert their debt into equity. So, actually, the shareholders will have their company taken away from them. An example of that is Marconi. You remember Marconi, which had quite a collapse. It didn't actually go into administration. But the shareholders landed up with, I think, 0.5% of the shares, so actually the creditors took over the company. And anyway, we are concerned that levels of debt can be unsustainable in a downturn if the company isn't successful, and the difficulty comes down to the people and the nature of the business and closing down parts of the business. Social responsibility. There's a question for companies here, who they're actually serving. Employees having to work at weekends, people having to work very long on social hours and not necessarily being respected, and say not having time off weekends to be with their families. The impact, of course, not only on the employees, but on the families if they're made redundant, the impact that can have on the people they're looking after. And something which I think is a growing phenomenon, I think they're called zero-hour contracts, that companies don't actually make people redundant. They put them on the contract which says, you're employed by us, but that's the good news. The bad news is we don't need to give you any work. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and a lot of people have been put on those terms. So they're given a limited amount, half a day a week or whatever it is. I think that may be one reason the employment figures are fairly strong, because a lot of people are on these terms. The companies are up to these devices. Investor distance, this is part of the issue, that in the 1960s, over half of the listed company shares were owned by individuals. It's now down to about 10%. So there are investment funds. Your and my pension funds have been invested in companies. There are sovereign wealth funds, there are hedge funds buying and selling shares on our behalf very often. And our instructions, whether you know it or not, the instructions you're giving to people who invest your money through your pension fund trustees are actually to make you money, to build up your pension. You have no idea, dare I suggest it, where your money is. Did you know we're probably all investors in BP? Do we feel any responsibility to what happened in the States last year for BP? No. Do we know our money's invested there? No. So what I'm saying is that the Investment institutions, the people who are actually at the forefront putting the money into the company, expect the money to produce, expect the company to produce these short-term and increasing returns. So we've really no knowledge and no interest, I'm afraid, in what's going on in the underlying companies. And yet these companies are employing people, they're expanding businesses, and they're creating wealth for society. Now, if you look at that, that just gives you an example, quite slightly simple, I think, of what we call the capital supply chain. So you can see on the left, the capital provider, let's say it's one of us who's got some capital we want to invest through an ISA or whatever it may be. We go to an IFA or a bank or some other advisor, and then they'll put our money to a fund manager, and then they may split it amongst several funds, and they will have people sitting in a room seeing which fund is performing best on a financial basis. And then, of course, you go through each individual fund, and then each fund is investing in the companies. They're going to have some sort of relationship, possibly, with the company, but they may not even have that. They may just be looking at the quarterly results. They may be looking at the share price. So the people whose share capital is being invested, as you can see from that, has no connection with the company. The directors don't know, generally, who the shareholders are. They may talk to one or two institutional shareholders, but it's not their money which is being invested. And that's an example of an equity chain, obviously there could be debt chains as well. Now, where does this come from? Well, we can look at some of the background issues, and they're rather fundamental. I mean, when I was a practicing lawyer, as Chris said, I was a partner at Sorter May for 26 years, I worked there for 33 years, and I had a broad-ranging corporate and finance practice. And when I was practicing in the city, I just accepted the structures as they were. And it was only since I retired 5 years ago and started working with Michael that I started to look at these things and looked at the problems, the real causes of what's going on. Don't just treat the symptoms, actually look at the causes to how this arose. And it's, I think, fairly fundamental, but it comes back to the way the company's operated. If you have a sole trader, or if you buy a house, say, you are clearly liable for the debts of that business. If you're a plumber, something goes wrong, or you have a bank loan or whatever to fund your business, you're liable for that and you accept that. If you buy a house, you're liable for the debt to the bank that's helping you to fund it. But of course, companies were set up as separate legal entities, and originally the shareholders would take responsibility. So you could be quite certain they'd be looking at what the company was doing and they would have liability if it went wrong. Now, in the Victorian times in this country and other Commonwealth countries, limited liability was introduced. And at the time, if you look back in Hansard, the debate was saying that actually this is the end of any moral standards in companies. And to an extent, you can see what's happened now, that it was actually correct. Because what happens is the company, and most of you, a lot of you know this, is a legal entity. It can take on its own debt, it can own its assets, it can sue and be sued, and it can have research and development opportunities in it, and it gives the stability and the continuity so that obviously one person is not passing it on to the next. It obviously makes sense from a certain point of view, and investors have come in, a sort of sleeping partner, sleeping investors, so they don't have any involvement in the business. But it does mean, of course, that the shareholders have no responsibility for what happens in the company. The worst that can happen to them, and obviously it's quite significant, is that if the company goes bust, they'll lose their investment. But they have no responsibility for the liabilities of the company. If the creditors aren't paying, if the suppliers aren't paying, if the company goes bust, or if the employees aren't paid, or if there's a shortfall in a pension fund, we as shareholders have no liability for that at all. And I think people don't often see companies in that light. Then, coupled with that, of course, we get share trading, as I mentioned before, and the market's gradually developed, and again, there is a gap, therefore, between people trading shares and the underlying business, what was actually going on in the company. There's actually no relationship. And therefore, you have this development of what's called, what we call absentee landlords, or Lord Miners called ownerless companies. It's an anonymous group of people that are trading the shares and have no relationship with what's actually going on in the business and the impact on people of their employment and so on. And the shareholders own the company collectively, but one of the commentators in the 1930s talked about the difference between those who own the company who don't run it, i.e. the shareholders, and those who run it but have no ownership interest, i.e. the directors. Now there's a lacuna there, isn't there? Because if the shareholders take no responsibility for what the directors do, and perhaps sometimes as recently they've been looking at the remuneration package, But otherwise, they don't really give guidance as to what the companies are doing, as long as they're earning money for the shareholders. But it means that the directors have a free rein. And what happens, therefore, if the shareholders aren't taking responsibility, the law has to come in. My background, so I'm very grateful for that. But law and regulation comes in. So, for instance, the Companies Act 2006, which I had a fair amount to do with as I was on professional committees looking at it, it's the longest statute ever, the longest statute on the statute books. And that is all to regulate directors, because there's no control from the shareholders. And therefore, the law and regulation has to come in and take its place. And then there are other codes, the UK Corporate Governance Code, there's the Stewardship Code, which actually don't go to the heart of the problem. A lot of that is mechanics, how companies operate, but not really going behind it and see the sort of ethos that the company ought to have. Because again, the directors are driven by the shareholders require for financial returns. So you can see that because of all this regulation put on directors, it is contrary to the sort of entrepreneurial flair that we really want directors to have. And I've heard chairmen of companies saying that a certain proportion, sort of a quarter or half of their boardroom meetings, is just dealing with regulation. They have to go through all this exercise. And it's not really to do with developing companies, developing wealth for all stakeholders who have an interest. So I think that summarises the sort of fundamental issue behind all this and how we need to try and address the problems. Now, what are companies for? Let's go back one stage before. The word company, compound, is breaking bread together. So companies are legal entities. As I say, they can expand, they can create wealth. So there is certainly a place for companies in providing jobs, in providing wealth, and developing new products, pharmaceutical products, as whatever they may be. They're there, obviously, to make a return to shareholders, for shareholders. And we said there's nothing wrong with making a return for shareholders. But they should have a responsibility in the way they treat other stakeholders. They should work for the common good and create value and sustainability. And the other stakeholders talking about, obviously, I've mentioned the employees, suppliers, customers, should they pay suppliers on time, treat them as equals in their negotiations with them. They should also have an involvement, we believe, with the local community, they should serve society generally. They should have a greater responsibility to society rather than having moved away to separate entities working for return to shareholders. In the final topic here is a light shelter value against stakeholder improvement approach. When I was in practice, I never really understood what enlightened shareholder approach meant. Well, it was something that the previous government came up with when they were talking about the Companies Act. What it means is, it's a bit of a cop-out really, it comes in the Companies Act, that the directors have to operate to promote the success of the company for the benefit of the members, for the benefit of shareholders, so ultimately for the benefit of the members. And in doing that, they've got to have regard to several issues. And one of them is the interest of the employees. Another is relationship, there's the word relationship coming in, with customers, suppliers, and others. So it's still subservient, that obligation to have regard, not take into account. There's a lot of discussion about what all this means. And I'm afraid companies very often use a box-ticking exercise. Have we had regard to these things? Yep, we've had regard to them, tick, tick, tick. And actually, let's make decision in the interest, basically, of the members of the company. Now, in South Africa, we'd quite like to move something to slightly more towards that. They have in their corporate governance code, the so-called King 3, because Mervyn King, not our Mervyn King, their Mervyn King, has an obligation in their corporate governance code to report on stakeholder relationships and to recognise the importance of the relationship with stakeholders. They're putting that at the heart of the company's operation. Now, that's how we develop our ethos. So we want companies to operate as a community of interest for the benefit of all stakeholders, and not just all stakeholders fighting for what they can to get what they can out of the company, because the company negotiates at arm's length with creditors, suppliers, all just trying to get the best financial deal. And we don't think that ultimately is in the interests of stakeholders. I'll hand over to Michael.
So, I saw many friends coming in this evening. Let me just say good evening to all the people who know me from around the room. and I hope I get a chance to speak to you and also to those I don't know during the time at the end of this talk. I'm very grateful to Jonathan Rushworth, because I'm local, so it's easy for me to come down the road to present this talk. Jonathan Rushworth had to come over from Gerrards Cross and spend the day here, and it's been good of you to come, Jonathan, and give us your time. So we've worked together on this for about 5 years. I suppose I've been working on some alternative to capitalism since about 1976, so you can work out how long that is. So why is transforming capitalism an urgent issue? Let me start there. I'd like to give you four reasons why I think the issue is increasingly urgent. I think, first of all, it is becoming clear that if you have a capitalist society, you have a single-minded pursuit of economic growth, which destroys social capital. It destroys families and communities. So I defy you to find any nation in the world that is capitalist that is not also marked by family and community breakdown. It is right across the globe where societies have gone capitalist, there is an inevitable consequence that you have a breakdown of family and community. And that is for a number of reasons, we believe. It is partly because you have mobility of labor, and as families move, you break up long-term relationships in communities, and you put extended family relationships at risk, because it's not extended families that move, it's nuclear families that move. A second reason for that very close association is that you get very long working hours, particularly go to Asia and look at the hugely long working hours. That means that people don't have time to spend with their children. In parts of Asia like Singapore or Hong Kong or Japan, you get declining marriage rates as well as declining birth rates associated with that. So, for example, in Singapore, you have them roughly losing 30% of their population every 35 years, or 35% of their workforce every 30 years. So these are enormous rates of social breakdown, if you like. And also the very long working hours just make it very difficult to put time into relationships outside the workplace. And relationships effectively require time. Time is the currency of relationships. So this idolatry of wealth is leading to the social breakdown. I think in many Western countries, and also across, again, many parts of Africa and Latin America that I visit, I do visit Africa quite a lot, that there is increasingly skepticism about capitalism and a loss of license to operate, as I call it. Companies lose license to operate individually, and the system as a whole is becoming unacceptable. I remember talking to somebody who was involved in rail track, and he was saying to me, how do you think you justify to somebody who drives a train and is on 30,000 a year that all they can get this year is a 3% increase in their salary, when he sees the managing director of rail track, or the chief executive, I can't remember which it was, getting 100% increase in salary? It's that kind of difference in salary increases that Jonathan was talking about that is making many people feel this just stinks. Is the capitalist system itself on a wider framework than just companies in meltdown? Well, I think it probably is. Let me give you one example. Take Greek debt. It's about $165 billion at the moment, which means that every adult in Greece owes the IMF and the Western donors and so on about $50,000. Can you imagine a situation where a married couple in Greece, which is not a particularly high-income country, finds $100,000 to return to the donors? And how many years would it take you in an average family in Britain to get hold of $100,000, £67,000, in order to pay off your debts? Well, I'm suggesting that debt is simply unpayable. Well, you say, oh, it doesn't matter, it's only Greece, for Pete's sake. Greece, a tiny country, 30 million, 33 million people in some corner of sort of southern Europe. Does that matter? Well, you say, what about Spain? Let's add Spain into the equation. Let's add Italy then into the equation. What about Portugal? And then you say, well, what about Britain? We are now up to about 86% of our GDP last year, 93% of our GDP this year in debt. The debt just keeps climbing. David Cameron's, of course, scaled it all down, but it's going down in the sense of going from 86% up to 93% in a year. And then what about the United States? The great, mighty United States economy is under severe threat now because certainly if you extrapolate and given the promises government has made to its own citizens and old people, it's just going to escalate way out of control. Oh, you say, well, it's plenty of time to put it right. The difficulty is that it's a political problem more than an economic problem because it's the political difficulty of getting the interest groups to agree to cut down their part of the pie and still vote for the government that makes it intractable for governments to deal with it. So meltdown, I think, is not an extreme word. Whether it happens in 3 weeks' time or in 3 years' time, or if we were very lucky, 10 years' time, it's coming. It's like a tsunami wave that's on its journey. And I think virtually impossible to stop. So I'm suggesting that if financial capital is currently destroying social capital, if money is destroying relationships, if I put it in that sort of everyday language, we need a Copernican revolution. Now, Copernicus was a scientist from Poland who in 1543 suggested the extraordinary idea, well, it was extraordinary then, that the sun does not go round the earth. Well, of course we know the sun goes around the earth. Just wake up in the morning, look where the sun is, look where it is in the evening. Obviously the sun has gone around the earth. But he suggested, no, 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 it's not like that at all. Actually, it's the other way around. The center of our solar system is the sun. And the earth actually goes around the sun. Well, it took about 100 years for people to get their minds around that idea. But we're suggesting that while at the moment we make our social relationships serve the interests of capital, we've got to somehow twist the thing on its head so that we make our social relationships the center of our world and we make money serve the interests of those relationships. We've got to change the way the system operates, and it's taken us quite a long time to work out how that might be done, and we're going to talk tonight particularly about how it's done in companies. So this relational approach comes out of originally out of a Christian worldview, out of what we call the Judeo-Christian tradition. And for those of you who are familiar with Christianity, you will know that it is a part, a religion about relationships. Every aspect of Christianity is about relationships. So our concept of God in Christianity as Trinity is a concept of three persons in communication before any material world existed. The concept of covenant is about a long-term stable relationship with God has with humanity and with his people in particular. The incarnation is about God coming to live on earth in order to have a face-to-face relationship with people. The cross is about the reconciliation of humanity with God. Reconciliation, again, is a relational term. Christian ethics is about love, not a financial term, but a relational term. Eternal life in Christian thinking is about a banquet. It's a banquet where people not only enjoy food, but talk to each other. But this relational approach conceptually is available and out there for anybody who shares that willingness to give priorities to relationships. So it's not an exclusive religious approach, it is an inclusive approach, because there are people of all religions and none who recognize relationships as the priority for human well-being. So we're suggesting all areas of life need to be looked at through a relational lens. So we're wanting to redefine the goals of development in relational terms. Now, this is a huge shift in people's thinking, because we're used to thinking of developed countries as countries like the United States, United Kingdom, West Germany, Australia, and so on, because they are high-income countries. So we have defined development in materialistic terms. We're suggesting, no, let us define development in relational terms. So a developed country is one with stable and humane human relationships. So where would you go for a developed country in the world today? Well, I lived in Kenya for a long time. Let me tell you, I think that on these criteria, Kenya is a much more developed country than the United Kingdom. So the arrogance that we have in the West of calling ourselves developed and looking down our long noses at countries in Africa and Asia needs to go through some radical transformation. So we want to see relationships in terms of ends and not means. We want to see it as the goal of economic life, but also the goal of all institutions, the goal of schools, of hospitals, of the criminal justice system, of finance, of economics, and so on. And that requires a shift of language, because the difficulty that we have in using or entering a discourse around the theme of relationships in public life is that we don't have the language to do it, because the language of relationships is so deeply personal. When you think of relationships, you think of words like compassion and trust and truth and things like that, which very often translate into our personal lives at a very individual kind of level. We're suggesting that we need a fresh set of vocabulary in order to discuss relationships in public life. And part of that is the idea of relational distance and relational proximity. Relational distance, for any of you who are academics, is coming in the literature, particularly in the area of sociology, where people are talking about factors that drive relational distance between people. We're saying that in addition to that, you need to turn relational distance on its head and look at relational proximity and the factors that drive closeness of relationships. So relational proximity, I wonder if I can come up with a definition off the top of my head. Obviously I've thought about this before, but I'm seeing if I can remember it. Relational proximity is a measure of the distance between two people or two organizations, which determine the ability of one to understand the intentions and behavior of the other. So relational proximity impacts in companies. We return to the company theme now and get down to the specifics in five main areas. So we're arguing that all relationships operate in five domains. The domain of communication, the domain of story or time, the domain of information, the domain of power, and the domain of purpose. And I think there isn't time now to dive into that too deeply. If you're interested in it, let me advertise a book that I wrote with David Lee called The Relational Manager, and refer you to that. But I think I won't dive into that now. I'm going to hand back to Jonathan Rushworth to talk about our concept of a relational ratings agency.
As Michael said, now we've really come on to what we're proposing, different aspects of trying to apply relational thinking, the relational proximity framework, as we call it, to companies. We're going to summarise those at the very end, but this is just one way of looking at this and trying to apply it. So we would have what we call a relational business charter, and the headings of that, don't read it all because I'm going to summarise it in the papers you have near the end of the papers. But it would be, it's a way of measuring, independent measurement of companies to see how they perform against the charter, which would give an indication as to how relational they are in their operations and how they treat all the stakeholders, employees, suppliers and customers and so on. So the agency would be set up as an independent body. It would be in some ways like a credit rating agency, although they're to a certain extent discredited. But it would be a totally independent body and would give an independent assessment as to companies' compliance with the charter's requirements. And it would be based on published information to start with. And we've actually done a test on this with four supermarket groups in South Africa and four supermarket groups here. And you can probably guess here, mustn't mention names perhaps, that one who's something to do with John Lewis is quite high, and another one which is something to do with somebody else, where the chief executive is paid rather a lot of money, is quite low. But we looked at published annual reports, interim reports, published information by the company, and their corporate social responsibility reports, and we've assessed them against a series of questions to see how well they comply with the charter requirements. And then points are awarded on that. They're marked against the 10 headings of the charter. And there are a series of questions which address the issues that we need to find the results to. And then there will be draft results will be shown to the company, and we'd say to them, do you want to cooperate on this? Do you want to discuss it? And if, for instance, they haven't disclosed, one of the issues is, do they give their employees time off, one day off, at least one day off at the weekend, and they haven't published that information, we would say, well, can you tell us that? And if you do it, you might like to publish that information, but we'll take that into account, or the agency would take that into account in the assessment. And then they would, the agency would publish the information, and it would be on a standard basis. So whereas all the companies have their CSR reports and so on, you can't compare them across companies. But by doing this, this is a standard model on the charter. You can go and compare, certainly within sectors, and you can see companies which are trying to move towards the charter requirements, for instance, reducing pay differentials. And we'd accept, obviously, that some companies are going to be strong in some areas, not so strong in other areas, given the nature of their business and how much debt they need to have. But the idea is that it would set a standard for a relational approach and see how well companies are complying. Now, the business charter provisions are contained, as I say, in the pack of papers you have. But the overall concept is, as Michael's saying, there will be something in its constitution to say that it is operating on a relational basis, putting relationships at the heart of its operation, not just financial return for the shareholders. And then directors and employees would have to be trained in the relational ethos, and it would be more of a stakeholder-inclusive approach, as I mentioned earlier. There would be greater dialogue with all stakeholders, not just shareholders. So they'd make much more out of the AGM, and shareholders were invited, but also other stakeholders, suppliers, customers, and you might get the employees, this is anathema to a lot of companies, actually meeting the shareholders and expressing their concerns, getting a greater understanding. And it's much harder for a director to, I think, to mislead somebody if actually they sit in front of a group of individual shareholders and talk to them and tell them what they're going to do. And some of the examples they can have of the Northern Rock unsustainable model of finance might have come out earlier if they'd actually sat with the shareholders, sat with the directors and understood what was going on. We would encourage individuals to hold shares. We want, say, 25% of the company shares to be held by individuals who come to meetings. We want to encourage shareholders to hold shares on a long-term basis. I mentioned before about the short-termism. And therefore, we would have some sort of reward. For example, if people held shares, or other shareholders held shares for, say, 3 years, they get additional bonus shares for doing that. There'd be a greater respect in looking after employees, encouraging employees to come with ideas, more discussion with employees, and, as I say, giving them time off from social hours. We would respect suppliers. Suppliers would be paid on time. There are lots of statistics in this paper about companies unilaterally paying suppliers late. They've got agreed terms of 30 days, paying 60 days, and of course small suppliers have no control over that. They say in Tesco, wherever it is, the good news is we're going to have an extra promotion of your strawberries next week. It's going to be 2-for-1. The bad news is you're paying for it. Pay differentials, as I mentioned, we would go towards 20-to-1. Well, it's not going to happen immediately, 20-to-1 between the highest and lowest pay, but we would expect companies to start to move forward on that, and they would therefore be marked as to how they're performing on that under the charter. There will be greater involvement with the local community, greater encouragement of local communities to come into the company's factory to get an understanding of what's going on. Debt ratios will be kept under control, more like the equity will be equal to the debt, so companies' debt wouldn't be unsustainable and get out of hand. There will be greater social obligation. I didn't mention the tax issue. We believe this is very topical at the moment, isn't it? Starbucks recently in the news, Vodafone, Asda paying virtually no tax. Do you know that apparently in this country, for the profits earned in this country, Amazon, Facebook, Google, on sale and Starbucks in the last 4 years on sales, combined sales of 3.1 billion, have paid 30 million of tax, Starbucks paid no tax in this country or profits earned in this country in the last 3 years. We would say that they've taken advantage of the education system here. People who work there have been educated by the state, the roads, the whole stable, we have infrastructure in this country, and so on, the political system and the police and so on. So we believe that that should be a contribution to a society, that companies should be seen to be good corporate citizens. Now, so you can see those measures to comply with the Charter of Requirements to show that they're operating to a certain extent on a racial basis, with a series of questions which are addressed against their published information, and then they've been marked, and then the results would have published. Now, who'd be interested in this? Well, we think investors would, shareholders, you and I, who are putting our money into companies, we think we might encourage our pension fund trustees to instruct their managers to invest in companies which are behaving responsibly to all stakeholders. And through that, we believe, create greater sustainability and, in the long term, greater profits of the company. So we think investors would like that. And employees and trade union, well, that goes without saying. I think employees would like to be treated properly, to be listened to, and so often you hear stories about people being put on these very unattractive terms and just feeling they're used as commodities to drive profits. Customers, we think they would be better dealt with. You might actually, when you ring your electricity company, you might actually speak to somebody rather than going through a whole lot of dialing tones. Is that what we want? Is that how we want to be treated? Well, probably not. Directors, well, we think it would, by doing this, by getting more involved from shareholders, they would be able to invest longer term in the company, not just looking for short-term profits, but actually develop the company in a much more constructive and sustainable way. And government, well, it would take, in the longer term, responsibility away from government to put in increasing legislation to control shareholders. So then finally, Michael's going to talk about the next steps. So we're going to box and cox on this one.
Yeah. So we're going to share this last slide because we wanted to try and leave a decent amount of time for questions. So what do we think are the steps by which one might transform capitalism from within? I think firstly we'd like to see the establishment of a relational ratings agency. We're familiar with credit ratings agencies, so why not a relational ratings agency? It is totally feasible to do it, as we have explained. You need a certain amount of capital, you need somebody with some energy and drive to make it happen. We haven't found the right person to do it yet, but if there's any volunteer in the audience, please come and see us afterwards. We're looking for somebody who would like to see this go ahead. Secondly, we believe that there should be a practice of measuring the quality and strength of stakeholder relationships in all major corporates, that is, relationships with customers, with suppliers, with regulators, with trade unions, with employees. We believe all of these are measurable, and a pattern of behavior should be established that this happens on a regular basis, partly for business improvement and partly for corporate governance. So we've started off on this in South Africa. We did work in 5 of the largest South African corporates in 2011. Where we measured 50 different stakeholder relationships, which came out with some quite dramatic results, and we put it together in what we called a relational balance sheet. We've been working more recently in South Africa with a range of other corporates, and we are in discussion with one of the big 4 accounting groups, both in the UK and in Australia, as well as in South Africa, to take this forward on a longer term basis. Clearly, companies are saying to us, this pays us. This is good for business, this increases profitability as well as increases social acceptability, and we think if this could happen around the world, if one could shift the language which corporates are using to think about their activities, that would have an enormous impact on the way that countries worked. Jonathan.
Another matter we're looking at, we've had a discussion with various MPs on this, and is amendment to the Corporate Governance Code. As I mentioned earlier on, there's the provisions in our Companies Act about directors' duties having regard to the interests of other stakeholders. And yet, there's a gap between that and the Corporate Governance Code, which deals with the more mechanical aspects as to how companies arrange their affairs and directors run companies. But there's nothing to explain how directors should have regard to those interests. So to shift the obligation more onto them having to look at stakeholder interests generally, not just looking at shareholder return. We want the UK Corporate Governance Code to include a requirement that companies have to measure relationships with all stakeholders and report on these, so this will be disclosed, and to have a greater obligation to take these factors into account. I'm doing a racial investment fund.
You are.
I'm doing a racial investment fund. Now, we talk about the racial business charter, and I say to you, well, you might like your funds to be invested in companies which are operating on a more relational basis, taking into account the interests of all stakeholders in the way we've described. Well, one way of achieving this would be to, like an ethical investment fund, we would seek to set up a fund which would invest in companies which score highly on the compliance with the relational business charter. And then you and I, if we think we might want to put our funds into an environment-friendly fund or whatever it is, a fund that doesn't invest in weapons or whatever, then we might want to put some of our money into that fund, and that we would know then that fund was investing in companies which are relational compliant, as it were, that score highly on the relational business charter. We want all this to be part of the debate. We want to be part of the debate. So many people are coming with ideas. Politicians don't seem to have many ideas as to how to sort out a lot of the problems on capitalism and the banks and so on. And they're going to steam away putting more and more legislation, but we think, as we've explained, that is the wrong way to do it.
And just to conclude, as more and more companies take up these ideas, we'd like to see a relational business forum to sustain best practice, share best practice among the group. And I think that will probably happen first in South Africa, because that's where we've got the largest group of companies already starting to operate in this space. But I think I must leave you with at least one challenge. So here, let me give you this challenge to take home and think about. If you follow up from what Jonathan was saying earlier and ask the question, what is the moral legitimacy of the return I get from my pension? So we put our money in, give our money to some pension fund, and then after some time we hope to get it back plus quite a lot, if possible. At the moment I know it goes down, but we all hope it's going to go up. And we hope to get this additional money coming back to us. What is the moral basis on which you expect that return? Well, you say, I put my money at risk in the markets, and that's how I get a return. The return is legitimated because I take risk. And then you say, well, what then is the difference between putting your money out there in the markets and simply going to the races at Newmarket and betting on some horses? Is there any difference really between betting on companies and betting on horses? In neither case are you involved at all. You don't actually train the horse, but you don't actually govern the company either. Now, I know this is a very uncomfortable thought, but I'm saying I think we have to ask the question as to whether, if you are not engaging with the company where you put your money, whether you really deserve that return. You are, in effect, an absentee landlord who's simply creaming off the profits at the expense of employees and other people who work in those companies. So I'm wanting to put the challenge to you that perhaps we should adopt a slogan. Here's my slogan: no reward without responsibility. No investment without involvement. And no profit without participation. Now, you may remember the original slogan of the American Revolution, which was no taxation without representation. And I have to say that most unfortunately the American Revolution was successful. And we've lived with the consequences ever since. But perhaps we do need a slogan. And we have to think through that slogan ourselves. We have to think about, well, what adjustments would we make to our own savings patterns if we were to adopt this slogan? Because it's quite a profound thing to do, to shift the way that you keep and save and use money. It means that perhaps you invest locally in a company like, and if I mention one, am I going to be accused under some piece of legislation of recommending an investment? So don't take this as an investment recommendation, but perhaps you go to Arm or one of these local companies and you put your money in there, and then every year you go to the annual general meeting and you ask difficult questions about whether they give people time off and how they're treating their suppliers and those sorts of things to make sure they're behaving properly. And you just follow on the company's activities, and by that sort of engagement, I believe you legitimate the kind of return that you get on its shares. But But it needs engagement. It needs all of us as citizens to start to actively engage with the companies where our money is being used. Money is probably the most important and powerful form of social glue. It provides links and connections between people. And if you take that glue out of our public life, what you do in the end is you create a building that doesn't have any cement, where the bricks are simply laid one on top of the other without anything in between, and that becomes a very fragile structure and one that is very prone to collapse. So I will stop there.
We will stop there, I think, and just see what questions you want to raise. I think Chris is going to come and share that for us.
And first of all, thank you very much. That was such a very stimulating. And challenging too. Yes, do please ask questions. Far away.
Hi, my name is John Bird. I founded The Big Issue, which is a company, an emergency company, which was created because capitalism and the government was not doing a good job of relieving the poverty of people on the streets, and the people on the streets were resorting to all sorts of antisocial behaviour in order to survive. And I'm very, very interested in this idea of reworking capitalism, because like yourself, I'm very unhappy with it. I think that the moral rectitudinal side, which you're suggesting, I think is wrong. I think that is one of the big problems, that when we start moralizing about the goodies and the baddies, I think we really do run into a problem. I don't agree with you when you say that somebody has a pension and they cream off the profits with no involvement. The fact that they put their money in is their involvement. We know that money is dead labor. We know that it is work that you have committed at some stage, and you lend your dead labor to somebody in order to make an investment. I'm very, very interested in what you're saying. I'm very interested in all this. But as a devout ex-Catholic who has had a belly full of goodness throughout many, many years, I'm an ex-homeless person, ex-sleeper, ex-offender, and all sorts of things. I've had my belly full of people moralizing about the goodies and the baddies. And I suggest that we could get nearer to the problem if we actually took away this kind of moral rectitudinalism and we concentrated on the way the system works and why it works very, very badly. I'll just give, if I'm allowed, can I give an example?
Yeah,
I won't be too long.
Yeah. That'd be helpful.
Yeah. I mean, let's just say Tesco's. Tesco's in the year 2011 made a profit, 2010, made to turn over £55 billion. Of that £55 billion, £5 billion was profit. £2.5 billion went to the shareholders. £2.5 billion was then split out amongst the company, £1.5 billion was split out amongst the company, giving a shedload of money to some people and the upper managers. £22 billion went into wages of everyday of the everyday thing. Now, last Christmas, because of the Occupy and because of a lot of other things that are happening, what we call the shareholders' spring and all that, suddenly Tesco's loses £5 billion worth of business, their shares fall by 18%. Now that is the strength of ordinary people saying, I'm not going to buy. And what we've got to do is find a way of tapping in to that enormous power. We're the people who make the rich rich. Mr. What's his name, who died recently, Mr. Jobs, didn't have a pot to urinate in until we started buying these problems. And if we take a moral attitude, we will never really understand how capitalism works. So I think it's fantastic that you want to reform capitalism from in. I'm also an ex-Marxist, Leninist, Engelist, Trotskyist, a Malthusist. I didn't do a good job there, but good luck. But let's take the moral out of it.
Just a brief response. First of all, John, we'd like to say how much we admire the big issue and the work you did with that. It's been absolutely amazing. So thank you very much. We're using the word relational, not moral. We're saying that what's wrong with the pension system is a relational issue. It's the disengagement between the pension, the person who provides the money, and how the money is used. So the fact that people who are putting their money into pensions have no idea where that money is used and no control or no influence over how it's used is where the system has gone wrong. And we're saying that there needs to be greater relational proximity between the provider and the user of funds. That's the basic proposition. So take the word moral out of it. Ask the word relational. What does it do to build relationships between providers and users of funds? Christ said, and I'm a Christian, and I realize you're not, but he made a very profound comment when he was talking about why interest was wrong. He said that it led to people reaping where they hadn't sown. And that is the heart of the issue that we're addressing.
I'd like to, thank you. I'd like to throw it open for others to respond. So, yes, please.
Thank you. I'm a devout practicing Roman Catholic, but I also have a very tiny Wixie political company. I have people who give me donations who only know that I wish I could actually give them a return. I don't know if it's early enough to do that, so I'm very grateful for that. For the donations, but I'm very much in this world that actually the cooling off, as they call it, frustrates me, because if people are generous enough to give me money, I am very grateful simply to give it back to them. They invest in me because they like what I stand for, but can they please then let go and let me get on with what I'm good at? Because my worry with this is that a lot of money is going to be going into make sure everybody's being nice to each other, good, supportive of that. And for me, I couldn't afford to necessarily, if I did have employees, to do that. And that's going to drag me back, suck my funds, and I am going to go on it. Small company, that is my concern with this possibility.
There'll
be a lot of talking, a lot of committees, a lot of, are you ticking this box, ticking that box, it's all paperwork, I'm photocopying, I'm people running up and down, I'm postage. Can I just run my process? If you trust my small ethos, then invest in me. I will do my best because I'm good at what I do, and then I can give you a return. But this could end up with a lot of faffing around, which will actually suck some of the companies down.
Please don't apologise. I'm not going to apologise either. Small companies, it may be fine because you would operate on a relational ethos anyway, I suggest. Somebody like John Lewis, someone like Ove Arup. Ove Arup is owned by its employees. John Lewis is owned by its employees. Do you pay your suppliers on time? Do you keep your debt under control?
Yes. Yes,
do you reward your employees properly? Do you give them time off at weekends? You see, you do all that, whereas a lot of companies simply don't do that.
So, you're going to have a limit, I suppose, small companies can still be...
There's no faffing around. This is an independent, that's the purpose, and I'm not sure it's moralising either. This is an independent exercise of the agency, the Relational Business Charter, scoring companies. Then people in the world can decide whether they think that's a good way for companies to be operated.
Be under this umbrella, though, as well.
No, it's mainly aimed at listed companies, because that's where you get the published information from. Okay, well, we'll get you. Here's a challenge for you. We will show you the charter. We will mark you on the charter, and you probably score very well. So you get even more people wanting to invest in you.
You might have to catch up later. I think there was a question just in front of you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, Jonathan, I welcome very much what you said, and Michael as well. I was distressed to hear about shareholders having no involvement in their companies. I have a lot to do with building companies, construction and development companies, and was very encouraged when one of the largest house building companies in Britain heard from their shareholders that whilst the bottom line was important, they wanted to build good communities. Now that seemed to me to be shareholders really participating in the company.
That's right.
And developing relationships, building on rock, not on sand, Christians might say. And so it seems to me that there are some companies,
yep.
It's not all despair and gloom, but there are models of this kind of thing. I have happen also to believe very much in the cooperative movement. And I bank with the co-op. I believe that their ethical banking gives the members of the bank an opportunity to participate. And now their excellent energy company does exactly the same. And so we're not actually distant from them. We're involved
excellent.
In the decisions and in the profits.
Well, that's great. And you would score well on the racial business charter. We're not saying all companies. I give you examples of bad behaviour. There are a lot of companies which have extremely good behaviour. And I've given examples of remuneration, say, John Lewis, the obvious one, with their bonus across the piece, not just to the senior people. Do you want to say something about the cooperative movement?
No, but I think he's endorsing the general principle. We're saying no reward without responsibility. And I hope most people in the room would basically accept that proposition, that reward should go with responsibility, that you shouldn't be taking a reward without taking any responsibility.
And what you're saying is exactly what we're saying. The AGM, I sat through so many AGMs when the shareholders tottered in and they complained because they didn't get lunch. They got a cup of coffee, and actually it was rather good because the directors went to have lunch afterwards and they fortunately invited their advisors, which was rather good. But there was no proper dialogue. We're suggesting in our report that people should put in questions beforehand if you want to discuss the account. You have a separate meeting, a face-to-face meeting with the finance director. HR, you have a face-to-face meeting with the HR director, or marketing, whatever it is. And you actually make something much more meaningful out of AGMs. So that dialogue is absolutely key, and we've explained that, our proposals there. And I quite agree with you. We're not saying all companies are bad. It does vary a lot. You hear about the bad ones, but you would score, the companies you're talking about would score well on the racial business charter. So again, we invite those companies to come in and be assessed.
Anyone else? I'm not an economist, but I suppose that it would seem to me that the banks are a major culprit. We talk about the financial crisis, it's about money. And the organisation that's most involved and has most responsibility in that are surely the banks. But you haven't said anything about how are they going to be brought to book, because it seems that they are the worst culprits in this business, and they just get away with murder. They just line their own pockets at the expense of the poor, and that's all. So what can we do about that?
I think the role of banks in our society has got so huge because we've become so dependent on debt finance. And if you read our book, After Capitalism, which is available outside, special discounted price this evening, so please do have a look at that. But if you have a look at that, you'll see that Paul Mills, who's a very senior IMF economist actually, and myself, argue that we need to get out of the stranglehold of debt. And the reason, fundamentally, again, is a relational reason, that, as it says in Proverbs, the borrower is the slave of the lender. And we see this, of course, when things go bad, very quickly coming to the surface. So we're suggesting a form of shared equity finance, for example, for housing, that gets you out of the whole mortgage scenario where we're stuck at the moment, and guarantees, in a sense, the person who's wanting to buy a house that they will not get into negative equity, which then is like being in chains, and you're then unable to move and you're strapped in where you are, and the only way out is to go bankrupt or simply to wait. You may have to wait now a very long time for the economy and house prices to pick up adequately, unless you happen to live in Cambridge and maybe one or two other cities around the country where housing prices are a bit more buoyant. So I think it's partly getting people out of a debt mentality. So in Germany, there is a very strong ethos against credit cards and against those forms of debt. And if we could get ourselves out of this debt mentality, people would live with a great deal more freedom and with a great deal less mental stress and psychological breakdown. Because the evidence, we've done a major survey of 1,000 people with multiple debt cases. I know John probably knows all this stuff backwards, but it leads to an enormous amount of child abuse, of wife battering, of psychological breakdown of all sorts, and people live with this immense stress because of debt. And in order to get out of that debt, we need a change in public thinking about how finance should be used. So I think all of that is part of reducing the role of banks in our society. And once the role of banks is substantially reduced, then obviously their role and manner of operation will shift.
Yes, another part of our thinking is very much about how you promote local banks and how you guarantee that finance rather than having these very, very small number of very huge banks. A big part of the problem is simply the scale of these banking institutions that makes it very difficult to hold them to account and means that effectively they operate with a guarantee that all of us as taxpayers have to give them. And for which we pay very heavily from time to time.
I think we've got time just for one more.
I've always had the idea, or I might be wrong here, that capitalism was actually produced or founded by the Quakers. And that was based on a sharing principle. And I think the word share has got sort of a bit out of balance. But if we, I worked for a company some years ago, and when they employed somebody, the rot has been going on for a long time. And when I worked for a company years ago, they employed somebody, they would employ the best they could. Now, today, in many companies, people who are employed, who are in the position of employing people, say in departments, especially where there's skill involved, the skill is dropped time and time again because one fear that the person that you employ could take your job. Now, the whole concept of that is completely wrong, but it's endemic in companies. And then you've got the greed side on the other end of the scale. And I saw an article about 3 weeks ago, which I think one of the church people picked up on. And
can I try and answer that? Because we're just running out of time. I'm just conscious that.
But the greed side of things, the church man, I can't remember his name, somebody had found out the banks, when they're employing people, if you had too high a moral standard, they would not employ them.
Well,
quite a few issues there. But
yes, there are quite a number of issues there. But I think the position I'm going to take may sound a little bit like John Bird, actually, in the sense that I think what Christian teaching tries to do, particularly if you go back to Old Testament teaching, which is the Judeo-Christian tradition section I was referring to, is that it tries to say, given the corruption and fallibility of human nature, which you're referring to and which I utterly agree with, people are greedy, they are selfish, they are, and the rest of it, how do you design a system that contains those pressures most effectively? What kind of institutional structure is going to prevent greed from simply exploding and dominating the way that we all live? And I think it is partly to do with smallness, it's partly to do with the way you organise finance as well, so that you don't rely heavily on debt finance that allows money to accumulate in a very small number of people's hands. And it's partly about keeping these pay differentials, you know, reduced, because even though it may be a relatively small number of people who earn these enormous sums of money, they cause incredible amounts of resentment and also upset people's well-being at a deep level. It creates social instability. So in all kinds of ways, we need to design a system that contains people's selfishness and greed. But I think to change human nature, I would say that is a much bigger and more ambitious project, and you really do then have to look to the whole role of faith to do that, rather than to looking to the design of the economic system. And you probably would agree with that, I expect. Thank you.
Okay, to wrap things up there, let me say a couple of things. The first is, I imagine like you will have been impressed by the fact that we had a presentation that was taken all the way from what you might call the big ideas, a Copernican revolution, a relational lens, a new perspective, right through to the nuts and bolts of policy making initiatives, this idea of a relational charter, a relational ratings agency, measuring relationships. And if you have, as I imagine you may, more questions, you don't feel you've necessarily got your head around all of that, then you might have heard there's a bookstore outside. So I encourage you to have a look at that, see if there's something in the way. I haven't asked Michael and Jonathan whether they have a little time today, but I hope they do. So do gravitate towards the podium if you've got further things you'd like to discuss with them. I'd just like to thank you both, Chairman and Chief Executive.
Thank you. 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 Thank you